Good afternoon, everyone. We'll call the meeting of the Agriculture and Rural Economies Committee together. The clerk will note the roll, note that we do have a quorum. And we'll start out continuing on with the Department of Agriculture, I think, in the overview. And if you all have your books, go through that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greta Gothier. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Department of Agriculture. And I believe that at our hearing on Thursday, we left off on page 17 of the governor's budget recommendations. So we're still going through the change items that we presented in an overview. Biennial budget change items might be handy to have that if you still want to refer to that. But we are now discussing the wholesale produce dealer's fee dedication. And what we are proposing mainly is to move that from the general fund to our dedicated agriculture fund. Because it is a fee program, that's where the rest of our fee programs lie. That way we can ensure that the revenue generated is poured directly back to the purpose for which the statute, the legislative intent designed it. And I have with me here Geir Friso, who is the head of our Plant Protection Division, to talk a little bit more about the background on this project.
Welcome, Mr. Friso. How are you today?
Very good. Thank you. Good. And my name is Geir Friso. I'm the Director of Plant Protection Division, and thanks for the opportunity to be here. And I'll be very brief. This is the Wholesale Produce Dealers Program is a program that's intended to protect producers who are selling their commodities to wholesale dealers. And what it is a bonding program so that requires a bond be in place to protect those producers. Currently, we receive an appropriation of about $80,000, which really is does not cover the entire program costs. It generates about $120,000 in fees, and we are simply requesting to change it into a dedicated account that would allow us to run the program off those fees generated from dealers' licenses.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Friso? Sounds good. You're getting off easy today.
That's the way I like it.
Yeah.
Now we'll talk about emerald ash borers now. Let's start.
Well, in just a few minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
The next item on the governor's change recommendations is the ACRA surcharge minimum elimination, page 18 of the governor's budget document. And I have Greg Buzicki here with me from our Fertilizer and Pesticide Protection Division to discuss this change.
Welcome, Mr. Buzicki. How are you doing?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm doing very well today.
Great, good.
Sun's out and
you're
snow's
able to
melting.
Dig out and get through the snow.
I made it.
All right, great.
Mr. Chair and committee members, on page 18, there is a small change item. A bit of background, I'll keep it very brief. ACRA is the Agricultural Chemical Response and Reimbursement Account. It was created about 20 years ago to provide essentially an insurance program so that people who spilled pesticides and fertilizers under our direction could get those cleaned up and the environment could be protected, and businesses or farmers would not have to undergo tremendous costs that they would have to incur if they did it in a in another type of program. Basically, you get reimbursed as long as you provide follow our guidance. You get reimbursed 80% of costs up to $350,000. It has done a tremendous amount of good in environmental protection and to the economy in rural Minnesota, and well, in urban areas as well. 2 years ago, we did a major fee change in the pesticide arena. We hadn't had a fee increase in 19 years. We asked for a fee increase, and we received support not only from the legislature, from the businesses, both in state and out of state. But we were also asked to take on a new project, and that was to collect our fees in a different way than we had before. Instead of collecting the annual gross sales fee from the big registrants that are largely located out of state, as we had been doing for years, there was an agreement that we would collect it from the agricultural dealerships in Minnesota. And I'm happy to report we've just finished that reporting session as of January 31st, and we had tremendous cooperation and compliance. The system worked. There was a problem that developed, however, and that is that in the original legislation, when we were collecting from the Syngentas and the Monsantos of the world, or smaller registrants, on a per-product basis, if there was a fee owed to the department of less than $10, that was waived. So we wouldn't have to mess with small checks because it's costly to process checks. When we did the fee change 2 years ago, we neglected to address that issue. So what we're asking for is that exemption for that $10 fee, because here's how it would work. If 600 dealers sold a small amount of a pesticide and reported it back to Monsanto, let's say, as the registrant, or reported it to us, and then we determined that the total fee was less than $10, we would have to issue all these refunds to 600 dealers of pennies or quarters or whatever it is. And that would be a tremendous cost, and that was never the intent. So that's a long explanation for a small change, but it basically cleans up legislation from a couple of years ago, saves us a lot of administrative costs and a lot of frustration by our dealers.
And Mr. Buzicki, what kind of shape is the fund in now? Have you got, what kind of resources do you have? Have you got adequate resources available now in the fund?
Mr. Chair, the fee collection, of course, goes to our pesticide regulatory fees, which I'll be talking about in a few minutes, and then also a percent goes, the surcharge goes into the ACRA fund. That ACRA fund is actually in very good shape. We reduced the fees. And that has been implemented this year. We reduced them a year ago, but there's a year lag. So actually, we're in very good shape. If you recall, Mr. Chair, we also asked, because the fund was in such good shape, we actually asked for additional resources to be used for staff to process more claims, if you will. And those staff have been hired, and we are working on more sites.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, on page 19 is an anhydrous ammonia change item. It is a proposal to, we are requesting a fee specifically on anhydrous ammonia of 75 cents per ton. This is a safety surcharge. The fee would raise approximately $222,000 annually once it was fully implemented. And the purpose for this fee is to increase our inspection routines on our approximately 300 anhydrous ammonia facilities. Anhydrous ammonia, as I mentioned in my overview, is a very dangerous subject or material. We have about 50 incidents per year. We have been doing inspections, but we can only get to facilities with the staff that we have. A little bit less than two staff are dedicated to this program right now. We only get to the facilities on a 3 to 5 year basis, and frankly, it's closer to 5 years. What we would like to do is change up our program, and in addition to adding additional inspectors, and these have to be highly trained, dedicated inspectors. It's not something that you want to send absolutely anyone to inspect anhydrous ammonia. It's very technically sophisticated. But in addition to hiring the new staff, what we would like to do is to develop a program in which We evaluate the risk, or we have a risk basis, and those facilities that have demonstrated good compliance and low risk would be inspected less frequently, while facilities that exhibited a high risk or had compliance issues would be inspected more frequently. We would do that through a rule writing process. In addition, we are in attempting to engage a rule writing change now, but we frankly have resource challenges, staff challenges, but the rules have not been updated for a number of years. And we believe that it would be time, especially with some of the emerging concerns and some of the incidents that we've had, to take another look at some of these setbacks that we have in place and so forth. So we'd like to develop a new program, hire more inspectors, change existing rules, and finally what we'd like to do is implement a $400 reinspection fee. So once we did an inspection, if it was determined that we needed to go back, that we would charge $400 for that reinspection fee. And that would serve as a incentive for compliance in addition to our normal compliance structure. Mr. Chair, I would imagine that there may be some questions, if not today, certainly down the road, and may have want to have hearings on this particular issue, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Well, Mr. Bezicki, could you tell me again the breakout of the fees? How much does the 75 cents a ton raise?
We sell approximately 275,000 to 300,000 tons of anhydrous ammonia, and that's listed up at the top. It raises 204,000,
okay,
I believe, and Mr. Chair, excuse me, it's 206,000, and I believe we had calculated 16,000 for the reinspection fee.
Okay. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bezicki, I think I mentioned this earlier in committee, but will the department be working with the Minnesota Highway Patrol to clarify who exactly is responsible for what part of the transport vehicle so that we're not getting doubling up on which agency is inspecting the hoses and the valves and who's inspecting the tires and the trailering mechanism, or what? Can you clarify to me where we're at and what's going on with that?
Mr. Bezicki?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, it's maybe even worse than you just described, because not only is there the Department of Transportation, the Minnesota Department of Transportation, there's also the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Public Safety Department, as well as the Department of Agriculture, all have a regulatory interest in anhydrous ammonia. The good news, though, is that we actually have coordinated with those agencies. In 2009, the three major agricultural chemical facility groups, at our urging, combined and coordinated with all of those state agencies. And we held a series of three workshops around the state in which we had all of those regulatory folks present. And I would say it's the best workshops I've ever attended. We had tremendous attendance from the facilities. And I think the facilities organizations were motivated for exactly the reason that you're talking about. There had been some inspections carried out by state DOT, public safety, and U.S. DOT. And I think those workshops helped to explain what our regulatory interests are. As a result of that, we actually have developed a multi-agency checklist with all the agencies signing off that has been distributed. So at least everybody is understanding that we're all asking for the same thing. The State Department of Transportation and Public Safety, we have a program in which you can tag anhydrous ammonia tanks so that they won't be inspected, basically say it's out of use, and if it has to be emptied and so forth, but then we won't inspect it, and the other agencies honor that. So we certainly have been attempting to coordinate to the best of our ability. However, DOT does have the ability and the authority and the responsibility to deal with these high-pressure vessels as they go down the road. We certainly have an interest from the fertilizer aspect. So I'm sure there's more opportunities to coordinate, but we have been, especially since 2009.
Senator Scoy, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate we use anhydrous on our farm, so I'm familiar with it, and I appreciate that it's hazardous material and that we have to be safe with it, and we want to make sure that that's occurring. On the other hand, you also want to make sure that people are able to use it. And what I'm worried about is that we're getting to the point where there's so much stuff going on with the transport of anhydrous that many of the fertilizer plants up in my area are quitting with anhydrous. It's quite an economic disadvantage to the farmer to have to use urea as a nitrogen as opposed to anhydrous. Which is a better nitrogen product, partly because of the placement, but it's also cheaper. And we want to make sure that that economic advantage can stay in place while we maintain our safety, of course. So if you're able to work through that and to help these facilities, you know, continue to offer the product, would be beneficial to our area. I know some of the folks now, the distance to the nearest anhydrous plant is, I think it's around 50 miles. Well, that's prohibitive at that point. So it's a concern at that level to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, yes, I'm aware of that, and we will continue to work. In fact, this initiative is part of that. What we want to do is really focus on the folks who either need additional help or need additional regulation and stay off the backs of those folks who already run a highly compliant facility.
Senator Kubley, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Bezicki, I guess, I brought this issue up with Ms. Gauthier a week or so ago, but you sound like maybe you'd be the person to ask. I guess I know that anhydrous is a volatile material, but, you know, I had a farmer's co-op that wanted to move their site from a place that clearly has a number of people living within the setback for a new site, and yet the department turned down their new site simply on the basis of a garage that's rented out and might get 3 or 4 visits a year. I mean, it just seems to me like the new site is 100 times safer or more. So what's the rationale for not allowing that move under those circumstances?
Mr. Bezicki?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Kubley, I recall discussing this with you, and frankly, there was another number of other letters and discussions that and appeals that were made on that particular site, and we actually did go back and reevaluate that. Frankly, it went to the highest levels in the department, and the original decision was overturned. So that permit was, in fact, issued. Having said that, one of the results of that was also this rule writing initiative that I just mentioned, so that we are embarking on taking a second look at our rules, because there are concerns about the location of some of these facilities to population. About 70% of our anhydrous ammonia facilities are located either in the middle of town, well, within a city limits, and that's based on a surveying about half of the facilities. So one of the things we want to do is, and Mr. Chair, members may be aware that last year there were 2 significant evacuations because of anhydrous ammonia leaks, one in Randolph, Minnesota, one in Morris, Minnesota. So what we want to do is take another look at how we're regulating this via rules, open it up and be very transparent, deal with the industry and deal with those people concerned, and take a look at that, Senator Kubley. So that permit was issued. Frankly, that facility is on the edge of town, and it's a matter of which direction the wind is blowing and what kind of leak we have. So all of that material can be dangerous. We are very, very aware of that.
Yeah, well, Mr. Buzicki.
Senator Kubley.
To quote you, I guess, having said that, it would be nice if the department would let you know that the certificate was issued.
As Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, as you began my began your question, I realized that I should have gotten back to you on that.
Thank you.
Yeah, any further questions? Senator Kelash.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Buzicki, what is this program self-funded, or is there a lot of other general fund dollars going into the monitoring of this program? I read it as like this is going to cover the extra inspection program that you're trying to do. Where's the rest of the funds coming for the current inspection program in relation to this?
Mr. Buzicki.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we currently, and I'll get into that in my division overview, but we do have a tonnage fee on all fertilizer, including anhydrous, currently as we speak. That fee is 30 cents per ton. That covers all of our emergency response that deals with fertilizer, non-point source, although we do have clean water dollars now coming in to help us out. It deals with our entire program. That fee raises, and there's also fees on various types of licensed applicators and so forth. All told, that fee brings in about $1.7 million each year. So, and that is dedicated, and we only use that money on fertilizer-related issues, but there's a lot of them. Okay. The 1.7 doesn't begin to cover all the costs that we have to deal with fertilizer. So what we're asking here is we have identified a specific problem that we're asking for a dedicated surcharge on, so we can build up just that part of the program, the anhydrous ammonia, and address it. There's so many pressures on that fee and that fund that this would be a way to really make sure that we focus in on it.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At this point, we have completed going over the specific changes that the governor's recommendations would include for our department. And now, moving forward through your budget document, we'll be going through the various divisions of our agency, what they do, how they're funded. And as we turn the pages, you'll be able to look at spreadsheets for those various functions and divisions within our department. So, getting back to our very big picture of our department, we have three main program functions, and one of them is our protection services. So under that umbrella, on pages 20, 21, and 22, you see a general description of what we're doing in protection services, and then a spreadsheet outlining our expenditures and staffing for those services. And now, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to just go in and talk about what we do under protection services that, as it relates to pesticide and fertilizer management. Okay, and I'll turn it back to Mr. Buzicki to go through that. So now we're on page 23.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we're on page 23. And if I can just make a personal comment here, my division has undergone several reorganizations. We used to be agronomy and plant protection. And as agronomy and plant protection, or before that agronomy services, I always went first on the budget hearings because it was A. And I thought once we changed our name to Pesticide and Fertilizer Management, I'd be tucked down the middle about where I want to be. Mr. Chair, that didn't work out so well. Here
well,
I am again.
Mr. Bezicki, you're experienced at doing this leading off, so we'll get you on base first.
Mr. Chair and committee members, on page, without turning to page 26, in a couple pages you'll see our spreadsheet high level, and if I may, rather than actually taking you down through the pages 23, 24, and 25, if I could just speak a little bit, because I know there are some new members here, and just kind of describe, give you an overview of the division, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions and, of course, take you through the budget numbers. Very simply, Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division regulates pesticides and fertilizers. So when it comes to virtually any issue of pesticides or fertilizers, whether it's registration, labeling, distribution, sale, handling, use, application, disposal, inspection, it falls into our shop. Originally and still to this day, the major purpose of pesticide and fertilizer regulation had to do with ensuring fair competition, making sure that quack products weren't out on the market, making sure that customers, largely farmers, received what their money paid for. However, in recent years, the last 20 years, we've been very much involved in environmental work. That began with the major changes that took place in 1987 with the rewrite of the pesticide and fertilizer law. Or the pesticide law, and then most significantly in 1989 with the passage of the Groundwater Protection Act, when we received a tremendous amount of responsibility for environmental protection. It was at that point that a line was drawn, and basically, if it deals with pesticides and fertilizers, it comes to the Department of Agriculture. If it's anything other than pesticides and fertilizers as a chemical contaminant, it would go to the Pollution Control Agency. Financially, we are largely dedicated, we largely deal with dedicated funds. We only have about $700,000 in general funds. Our division budget, which we'll go through, is generally about $15 million a year. We have four major categories responsibility, and that's in the traditional pesticide and fertilizer regulation, water quality protection, pesticide and fertilizer emergency response and remediation. For example, we do Superfund work and we do 24/7 emergency response work. And then finally, in Clean Water Fund research, demonstration, and outreach. That's something that's been relatively new, a new assignment to the division. I'd make a point. I know some of the members are not from an agricultural background. While I am a member of the Department of Agriculture and the division rests here, a tremendous amount of work actually happens in urban areas. In fact, on a per-product basis, we register about 13,000 pesticide products. The majority of those are actually used in inside buildings or in urban situations. Volume-wise, there's a little bit more that actually is used in the agricultural area, but on a number product basis, there's actually more products that are registered for non-agricultural purposes. We have about 85.
Senator Scoit, to that point.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Bezicki, would you repeat that about the volume? Are you telling me that the volume-wise, agriculture is just over half?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, yes, I'd say about it's about 55-45 if my memory serves right, but I'd be happy to check into that.
Interesting. Thank you.
We have, Mr. Chair, we have about 85 staff people, and most of our staff people, we have a tremendous support staff, of course, but most of our folks you can think of as technical and scientific. We have PhDs, masters. We have the typical type of employee has a soils or hydrology background, sometimes agronomic, sometimes not. And, Mr. Chair and committee members, if you would like to see a very good overview of the division there, and especially in the pesticide program, The legislative auditor did a report on us in 2006. It's a little bit dated, but it it does describe our division and our responsibilities exceptionally well, although we've had some changes and new responsibilities since then. Mr. Chair and committee members, dollar-wise, we bring in about $7 million in pesticide fees and about $1.6 million in fertilizer fees. We have surcharges. We have surcharges for pesticide and fertilizer that go into our cleanup fund. That cleanup fund is dedicated, with the exception of a small amount, can be used for staff activities. We also have clean water funds. Those are also dedicated to focus on clean water, and we take great pride in tracking those funds so that we can be held accountable. We receive a small amount of general fund, about $650,000, $700,000 each year. A small amount of federal funds, only about $400,000 each year. For our Superfund work, we do receive some administrative dollars, $388,000. We reserve about $2 million for cleanups each year. The committee may be interested to know that the last federal Superfund site in the state of Minnesota was a Department of Ag site. It was the arsenic site, and it was in South Minneapolis. And at this point, I believe about $30 million has been spent not only cleaning up the original pesticide arsenic facility, but also about approximately 500 yards that had high arsenic levels. Very quickly, I'd just like to go down our regulatory our program areas by name so that you have an idea of what we do. First of all, in both program, fertilizer and pesticide, we have licensing and certification programs. We do inspection and investigation. Once those inspections and investigations are complete, we may be doing enforcement activity. And we do have incident response. In our vernacular, incident response involves long-term contamination. These are very old sites that need cleaning up. But we also deal with 24/7 emergency response. And since we've been doing this the last 20 years, we've responded to over 5,000 pesticide or fertilizer spills, some of which certainly would have gone unreported. And now that material has been properly cleaned up and disposed of and doesn't present an environmental problem. In our environmental area, we have a monitoring program. We've got very sophisticated groundwater and surface water monitoring programs that have been active since 1985 and 1991, respectively. Take great pride in finding and making sure that when we speak about policy or contamination, we can refer to facts. And that's what our monitoring program does.
Mr. Bozicki, that'd be very good if we could base some decisions on facts around here. Just an editorial comment. So continue on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for not phrasing that as a question. to continue, we also have pesticide and fertilizer management units. These are units that actually determine best management practices, promote best management practices, and make sure we translate the label information or the monitoring information to growers as practices, things that that people can actually do to improve their practices and protect the environment. A good example of this is in our pesticide management area. The auditor told us that we should be doing more with our registration program, so we initiated a pesticide-specific registration review. We take a look at products that may cause environmental problems and take a look at them from Minnesota perspective. We completed one on atrazine, and we're in the process of completing one not on a particular product or active ingredient, but all the products that are being used for EAB, because we know that's going to be something that consumers and applicators will be those products they'll be using. We want to make sure that people have the right information, and we'll be coming forward with that program shortly. In addition, we have pass-through programs. We fund clean water research. through an RFP process. I mentioned that last week. Senator Rosen had some questions. The AFREC program, which is farmers paying 40 cents per ton of fertilizer, they have their own council. We are the fiscal agents, and you'll be hearing about that program, but that has focused on production, soil fertility production, and environmental research. The ACRA program, our cleanup program, Superfund, and we also do waste pesticide collection, household and agricultural. Overall, the breakdown of our division is 43% of our dollars go to staff resources, 13% go to operations, pass-through, research and cleanup and so forth is 32%, and our indirect costs are 12%. Mr. Chair, if the members would like to go to the page 26, we have the numbers there. You can see the current appropriation levels and the governor's recommendations. I can go down very quickly if you'd like. We have, as I said, about $600,000 in general fund. Our remediation fund, you can see the operating reductions there in the bowl type. The next designation is the remediation fund. That is Superfund money that we use for scoring and administrative costs. And we have an open appropriations, you'll see at the bottom from that MRLA account, of $2 million. Basically, how that works is both the PCA and the Department of Agriculture reserve a certain amount of that money that's available each year for various projects that we anticipate or could come to fruition. Remediation, the appropriation for the staff comes out of the $388. Any cleanup costs would come out of the $2 million. At the middle of the page, you see the clean water funds. These are funds that are being used for the research and the demonstration work and to help the monitoring. I explained some of that the last week when we talked about the clean water programs. And following down the governor's recommendations, you see the drinking water. That is also clean water dollars, the pesticide monitoring and assessment at $350,000 each year, and the research evaluation assistance at 1.7. Mr. Chair, at the bottom of the page, you'll see towards the bottom of the page, you'll see the agricultural fund that includes the pesticide, fertilizer, waste pesticide, and the ACRA account. Total request is a little bit over $12 million. The revenues for those programs, we're still collecting revenues, but they're basically in balance with that request for appropriation. And, Mr. Chair, if there are any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Questions? Senator DeCoubley?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bozicki. I guess on pesticide monitoring and drinking water, has there ever been, well, it seems like when you talk to people, they say, well, so many parts per million of this chemical won't hurt you, and so many parts per million of this one won't hurt you. But nobody knows how they act when you take them all together. It's kind of like picking the carrots out of vegetable soup and saying, well, this has too many, you know. I don't know. I mean, you get the point. You know, you take them as a mix.
Mr. Bozicki, is there a multiplier factor in some of these?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, excellent question. The registration of pesticides and all that testing takes place at the federal level. They do test each product and each, not only each product, but each breakdown product. That's the metabolic breakdown, chemical breakdowns that happen, that they have any toxicity, they measure those. But you're right, they measure them one at a time. There is limited research on the synergy, the synergistic effect of multiples of those materials. It's something that I know that EPA has been looking at. It's a challenging thing to do. There has been some work on it, but certainly not very much. It's an area of emerging research and concern.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Buzicki. I suppose since I have an undergraduate degree in science, I could say that it points out one of the limitations of the way we do science, in that, I mean, in a sense, it's kind of like saying the rabbit heart question. You know, if science were to look at a rabbit heart, they'd say there's no difference between a rabbit heart outside the rabbit or one inside the rabbit, but it makes a world of difference to the rabbit, you know. Just an observation, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Okay, Senator. All right, Mr. Buzicki, I think we'll hold the questions there on that division then.
All right.
Thank you. Oh, Senator Stump, did you have a... By the way, yeah. Senator Stump, how are things going with your family? You and your family have been in our thoughts. I wanted to tell you that. I meant to mention it to the committee the other day. I know you've gone through some turmoil there and with the loss of your brother-in-law, and I want you to know that you're in our thoughts, Leroy. And
thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. The question I had was, do you break down licenses that are sold into different categories, and if so, are not sold, but the pesticide certification, is that broken down into like ag and commercial, what categories are those divided into?
Mr. Buzicki?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, yes, we do break those down. We have revenue streams I don't have handy, but we could provide those. There's, I believe, 14 different categories of licenses. For example, there's the structural pest control operator. That would be what we typically view as exterminators, but they also do fumigation for grain. Aerial applicators, aquatic applicators, non-commercial would be a DNR employee who applies pesticide as part of their job. So there's 14, I believe, 14 different categories, and we have revenue streams on each.
Okay.
Very good.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are you finished?
Yeah. I'm done, and Mr. Chair, if you or the committee members have any other questions, right, be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. We'll probably talk about anhydrous another day again, but we'll see. At this point, I want to welcome it's poultry day here. We're getting inundated by our poultry industry, so we want to welcome our friends with the turkey and poultry industry here, and so I hope you enjoy the meeting. We're going through overviews of the budget proposals here today, so welcome to the committee.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to keep everybody on the same page, we're on page 27, and still talking about our function of protection service, but now we're going to switch gears and talk about plant protection. And I have with me Geir Friso, who is our division director, back again.
Hello, Mr. Friso.
Good afternoon. Thank you again for allowing me to be here today. Plant protection, we are the smallest regulatory division in the agency, but I guess good things come in small packages. So our division has two primary responsibilities. One is that we provide certification services for plant products and commodities, and then the other half is sort of charged with detecting and excluding potential plant pests that may threaten agriculture or the environment. I'm not just in a minute. As Mr. Buzicki indicated, I didn't want to go through the narrative. There's just a lot of numbers there, and so I was trying to figure out the best way to provide a meaningful overview to the members. So I thought I would just sort of go through very quickly the different areas in my division and explain some of the revenue and we have.
Well, and Mr. Friesel, I believe the members have these two
right
graphs in your materials, and I would point those out if you're going to use these, that the tremendous increase in exports and the increase in phytosanitary certificates and so on that your division will be required to issue. This is good news. I mean, it's good news in the volume and everything else, so we're supporting that. But I'm sure it's adding to your workload there by a lot.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and I appreciate your pointing that out. That is a growing program. It's a dedicated program, and other countries in the world require certification that commodities that we export to them are free of certain pests and diseases. So we provide that inspection service. It brings in about $200,000 revenue every year. And if you can see from those charts, there has been a tremendous increase in exports, especially to Asia and China specifically. So some very interesting data there. One of the areas that we have responsibility for is the fruit, vegetable, and grain program, and that is a service where we inspect fruit, grain, shipping point potatoes, really for a grading service on which the fees are based on how those are sold. That is a completely dedicated account. It brings in about $600,000. A year. Also in there, we do we have a grain bonding program, which brings in about $500,000. Also dedicated to fee. That bonding protects people who store grain or broker grain. We have a seed and noxious weed unit. The seed program ensures that the seed farmers and producers buy is labeled correctly. That the seed germination is good, and the purity is good, and that is also it's about $1 million dedicated program. Our nursery inspection program, we inspect nursery growers and stock, again to ensure the viability of the plant material and also freedom from harmful plant pests and disease. And this is an area that nursery stock is an excellent pathway for a number of plant pests and pathogens, and this is why it's very important to Minnesota. Gypsy moth, emerald ash borer, barberry, which is a carrier for black stem rust on wheat. These are all prime examples of pests that can come into on nursery stock, so it's extremely important that we have a strong inspection program for a nursery stock. And again, that's a 100% dedicated account. It brings in about $750,000 a year. Also, with that nursery account is that export program that I just mentioned. We issue between 3,000 and 4,000 export certificates every year, and that number increases every year, as does the complexity of the export requirements. Our pest detection and response program is the area that probably has the most general funds associated with it. We have about $650,000 in general funds, and then we typically receive about $1 million in federal funding. And this is where our programs, such as monitoring for potato cyst nematode, carnal bunt, Rostonia blight, soybean rust. And the ones that have really gotten a lot of attention, of course, are emerald ash borer, which was found a few years ago in St. Paul and Minneapolis, and then also gypsy moth. Many of these survey programs that are done with general fund dollars also help us ensure open markets for a number of products. So if somebody is moving wheat, for example, to Canada, they're going to want to know about the cereal leaf beetle. And because we are able to do these surveys, we can prove the absence of those particular pests from certain counties. Or soybean cyst nematode is another example, although it's becoming fairly widespread now across the state. Programs like Emerald Ash Borer are almost 100% federally funded. We receive anywhere from $750 to close to $1 million in federal support for that program. We have a potato inspection program, which is sort of divided between seed potato inspection. That's another dedicated account. It generates about $240,000 in fees. And then we have a shipping point, potato shipping point inspection, and that is partially dedicated and then also receives about $250,000 in general fund support. We do have an office in East Grand Forks. Seed potatoes is an area that's in a bit of a decline in the state of Minnesota, so it is becoming challenging for us to maintain that program. We have
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I think I mentioned this to the committee before, but I don't know if you were here. I think that we need to look at combining the certified seed program with North Dakota. A lot of that stuff is done in the geographic area of the valley. It would make a lot of sense to combine with them. Mr. Shaga from Minnesota is head of the North Dakota, so he'd be familiar with what we're doing. It seems that it would be the time to do that, and I would hope that there's somebody's making some effort toward that goal.
Mr. Frazo?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, and we did follow up on your observation the last time I was here, and we have made some preliminary contacts, and we have been talking with Willem Schrage a little bit, and there certainly would be some efficiencies in that consolidation. I detect a little bit of I'm not so sure some of our potato growers yet understand the need for that at this point. I think they like having a Minnesota Department of Ag to go to, but there's some economics that drive those decisions as well. So, let's see. We also, the gypsy moth program, and I brought a couple of vials of gypsy moth. And if you're familiar with forest tent caterpillar, this is sort of the big brother of forest tent caterpillar. It's something the department has been fighting for over 30 years with great success. But it is slowly getting here. The state of Minnesota provides about $400,000 of general funds to support this program, and then in return that we are able to leverage about $500,000 in federal funding. So it's a good ratio. And then in addition, U.S. Forest Service provides the treatment costs to control gypsy moth, and they expend about an additional $1.5 million every year to control gypsy moth using pheromone flakes, primarily up on the North Shore. And then a last benefit I always like to point out is by ensuring that gypsy moth does not become established in the state, we are able to avoid having the state of Minnesota quarantined by USDA. If a state fails to maintain adequate defenses against these plant pests, the USDA quarantines the entire state. And that would put industries such as nursery, the timber industry, at a significant competitive disadvantage if the state were quarantined. So what the dollar figure value of that is, I don't know. But for a $400,000 state investment, I believe that there's a tremendous payback for the state of Minnesota. And then just a couple of small programs I'll mention in ending. We do provide inspections for apiary. A number of Minnesota apiaries move their colonies to California and southern states for pollination services. That's another dedicated account. We have a wolf depredation account, which compensates cattlemen for loss due to wolves. This has been a program that's actually, we've had seen some significant increases in claims for wolf depredation. And then last, we have a elk damage fund. And this is another one where we saw a huge increase in elk damage up in north central Minnesota. And the cost damage that an elk can do is tremendous on a farm. And DNR was able to took some actions to depopulate one of the herds that was causing the most problems. So those claims have decreased significantly. So with that, I'll end saying that in general, we generate about half of our revenue is from fees. That's about $3 million. We have about $2 million in general funds, have anywhere from $1 million to $1.5 million in federal support dollars. And looking on page 29, maybe I should point out there's a $2 million listed for Outdoor Heritage Fund. That was a one-time appropriation. That was an appropriation intended for pass-through to municipalities to deal with emerald ash borer. And about half that money went to, at the time, it was just the city of St. Paul that was infested, and then the other $1 million was passed along to communities for preparedness planning for EAB and other forest pests.
Okay, Mr. Friesel, I'd point out, too, also on page 28, about half the way down, you know, when you're talking under your key activities and goals, I'm impressed by your ability to get the licensing and bonding requests out and inspection certificates and so on, you know, just in a matter of, in some cases, hours. And that's pretty impressive. And I think that's a testament to our Department of Agriculture being able to do that to support our programs. And also, I have a request. Would it be possible for me to have one of these? Because I got to tell you what happened. I took one of those little emerald ash borers home and took it. My kindergartner took it to show and tell the one day in school, and she came home from school and said, "Grandpa, I hope you don't ground me." I said, "Well, what happened?" She said, "Some kid took my bug." So I didn't want to ground her, so maybe I could give her one.
Well, Mr. Chair, first off, thank you for the kind words. Okay. I think the department works very hard. I actually do have some more emerald ash borers. Okay. If you want some. And you're welcome to have both the gypsy moth. Now, Dr. Kassenberg asked me for two emerald ash borers because she was trying to make earrings from them. So.
I think that might have happened. Yeah. All right, thank you very much. Senator Keeler.
Yeah, just to follow up on the emerald ash borer, how are we doing as far as maintaining on the ash borer and on the gypsy moth? Is there adequate funding? Do we need, you know, are we falling behind because we don't have enough funding, I guess is what I'm looking at?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a very good question. It's a difficult one to answer, too. I think with emerald ash borer, Minnesota is in the very early stages of an infestation. And to be quite honest, it's not a battle we're going to win. Mm-hmm. I think we've done, in my opinion, about everything we possibly can. We've removed 300 trees. We've got another 200 trees, suspect trees that we've identified in the area that St. Paul and Minneapolis are taking out. But experience in other states is no matter how aggressive they've gotten with tree removal, they have never been able to stop it. That said, we did release over 2,000 stingless wasps as a biological control agent, so we're hopeful that will slow things down. We are taking out as many trees as possible. We have a quarantine in place, so we're trying to at least slow things as long as possible. But my honest opinion is additional funding for the program, unless we lose federal funding, is probably not necessary for emerald ash borer. In the case of gypsy moth, there's two ways gypsy moth moves. One is working as a hitchhiker, and hence its name, gypsy moth. And those are the little spots that we have been putting out for over 30 years. And we have very good detection tools for gypsy moth. And we have done a very good job, I think, winning that battle. We also have the pheromone flakes does a very good job of of reducing the population. But there is also, in addition to those hitchhikers, there is a natural slow spread of the front. And that front, the females are flightless, so that kind of slows them down. But that front is about halfway to two-thirds across Wisconsin. As that front moves into Minnesota, and right now with the STS program, it's believed that the front is slowed to about 3 miles per year. If there were no mitigation efforts made, that would probably increase to 17 to 20 miles per year. So it is being slowed. My personal opinion is it'll be another 5 to 10 years before that front reaches Minnesota, and so our best efforts are to keep stamping out those spots that show up, and assuming that we can maintain, and I know this is going to be very challenging, the current budget crisis in Minnesota, if we can maintain some sort of general fund support, and then working with the federal government, I think we have a good handle on gypsy moth.
Senator Keeler.
Based on what you just said, does that mean Minnesota is eventually going to get quarantined, and we have to plan ahead for that quarantine?
Mr. Friesel?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. Although typically it's done county by county as long as the state has a program. If the state did not have a program, then USDA would quarantine the entire state carte blanche. So, again, there's an advantage for us to stay in the program, so at least we can keep it to a county-by-county level. But, again, you have to have a reproducing population of gypsy moth before you quarantine a county, and I think we're still a few years down the road before that happens.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and sorry to go back to this potato inspection, but what exactly did you tell me was going to be the outcome? I heard you say that there were a couple of farmers that were objecting, but does that mean you're not going to continue to pursue it, or are we going to continue to pursue this consolidation and try to bring consensus with the growers, or what's the plan?
Mr. Friesel?
Mr. Chair, Senator, right now I would say we're very, very early discussion stages. I know Commissioner Hugeson, this is something he had also mentioned in the past as something we should consider, and I think we will continue to make inquiries with North Dakota, just from the economics of it. If the number of our seed producers drops to a certain level, you just can't charge people enough to support the program. So it just makes good business sense.
Thank you for that, and I will continue to ask how you're doing. I think I'll also contact, I have talked to the head of the Potato Growers Association so that they're aware that I'm working on it. I might take the liberty of contacting the North Dakota folks and encourage them because I'm familiar with them.
I'm not sure we're going to get through everybody today, so which do you want, Board Animal Health, or you want Heidi to come up and talk about dairy, Dr. Kastenberg, or flip a coin, or how do you want to do this?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
we've got about 20 minutes left, so I want to make sure the committee's gets their questions answered they need. So,
Mr. Chairman, I would say that the dairy and food inspection is a very important function of our agency, and so I think it might be helpful, especially for members who are newer to the legislature or to your committee, to get a better picture on what those activities might be.
So you want to have Dr. Kastenberg come up now? And then
it's ultimately your call, Mr.
That'll
Chairman.
That'll be Dr. Hartman. If you come back, can you come back Thursday, Bill?
Absolutely.
If you could do that, that'd be good. We'll probably only get one done today because we need to talk about some of these things.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
So I'll ask
Dr. Kastenberg
to come up and talk a little bit about our food and dairy inspection.
I'm not going to call you Senator right away, no.
Well, I wasn't going to bring it up,
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Heidi. How we doing?
Good. For the record, my name is Dr. Heidi Kastenberg. I'm the Division Director for the Dairy and Food Inspection Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So I'm going to give an overview of our Dairy and Food Inspection Division. As you might guess, our role within the MDA mission, primary role is to ensure the integrity of the food supply. And so what are our statutory responsibilities? Where do they start and where do they end? That's helpful to know because the food system, both within Minnesota as well as federally, can be very difficult to piece together from a regulatory point of view. Our role starts at the farm, at the dairy farms, and then we go on to the processing facilities. So we do dairy, feed, food, meat processing, distribution on up to the retail level, so what you might consider a grocery store or a convenience store. Then our statutory responsibilities end, and it goes on to the Department of Health. So they take over at the restaurant or food service level. And then they also, another part of their agency does the foodborne illness monitoring amongst the human population. And if they see something that's unusual, then either from reports or from isolates that they get from cases of foodborne illness, then they will contact us if they think it's a foodborne food product, and then we'll do the trace back for them. So really, the dividing line is the plate level. And so we monitor what goes in, and then they monitor what comes out. That's kind of a way of remembering it. So we can look at our entire division from a funding point of view, but it's probably easier to look at it because it gets quite confusing because there's a whole mishmash of federal, state, matching funds, dedicated funds, and the like. So it's easier to look at it by program area. And so we're divided into food, dairy, meat, and feed divisions. And so I'll start off with our dairy activities first. Our dairy funding is half, pretty much half dedicated and half general fund. And so that's it's split 47-53 agriculture or dedicated fund to the general fund. That program is headed by Dr. Nicole Neeser, who's also a veterinarian. She's the program manager. And there are two supervisors, one for the north and one for the south, 14 inspectors, and then three what we call interstate milk rating officers, which ensure that the job that our inspectors are doing is of such a quality as well as the plants that they, as well as the plants, so that we can continue to ship milk across state lines. If we fall below or a certain area of the state falls below, then that milk shipment can be interrupted. We conduct inspections for grade A farms as well as grade B farms or manufacturing. We have approximately just over 4,000 grade A farms, and those what we consider grade A, that's fluid milk, the milk that you get in the you know, gallon, half-gallon containers in the grocery store. And then the manufacturing grade varies anything from whey product to dried whey product all the way to cheese. A lot of it, most of it goes into cheese. We are also responsible for inspecting the plants. Farms are inspected twice a year, the grade A farms. Grade B are done once a year, and then the plants are done quarterly. And so they go into the plants, and one of the main things that they do there is making sure that the pasteurizers are working correctly. Pasteurizers are what heats the milk to a certain temperature for a certain time to kill any pathogens that might be present in the milk. Our inspectors, of course, live where they inspect, and so they are distributed where the dairy farms are. So they're distributed all throughout the state. We have taken advantage of some cross-training in some of the areas where there's not as many dairy farms, and those inspectors are trained for meat and also for food facilities. We've got a couple of those in the corners of our state. So that's it for the dairy program. I'll go on to the food inspection program. That's our largest and our broadest.
Dr. Kassenberg, could I ask you, when do you inspect milk? Do you inspect it? Okay, let's say you got 4,300 dairy farms. The bulk truck goes out and collects that milk and brings it to a facility. When is that milk inspected?
Mr. Chair, the actual milk is inspected at different points. The inspector inspects the animals that actually produce that milk. They look at the facility at the farm to make sure that the facilities are clean and are being kept up in a manner to produce either grade A or grade B milk. And then once it goes into the tanker, we ensure that the milk truck driver is doing things correctly as well, and we issue a permit for them. Then when it gets to the milk plant, before that milk actually gets into the facility, it has to be tested for antibiotics. And so before that even, it often has before even the tanker gets hooked up, it has to pass a test to ensure that no antibiotics are in that load. If it passes, then it goes on into the facility. We don't conduct that test there, but we audit the people that are doing those tests. Additionally, samples of milk are taken from each bulk tank, and our laboratory tests those samples of milk for, as well as the milk plant for things such as somatic cell count, bacteria counts, and the like. So it's many different places. And then when it hits the retail store, or we take some samples there, but we also sample finished product at the dairy plants as well to look for both quality and safety of the product. So there's really not one particular answer on that. It's a whole system, really.
So, but in essence, you that milk is inspected before it's unloaded into a facility.
That's okay. Correct. That's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. Then, if there's no more questions, I'll go on to the food inspection program. This has a very broad responsibilities. It covers things that are not dairy, as far as manufacturing. Not meat and not feed. And so that particular program is funded primarily over 70% by the general fund. A small portion is dedicated. That's primarily a plan review, and also we get some specific money to inspect canneries. And then we do get some federal funding. We conduct inspections on behalf of FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, for food manufacturing facilities. And so we get a contract of about $500,000 a year. It's actually less than that. It's probably more around $400,000 to conduct manufactured food facility inspections for FDA. It's important to note that the majority of food inspections in the United States are conducted at the state or local level. 44 states have contracts similar to this from FDA. One of the things that we have to do, though, is maintain the quality of our inspection staff, and we also have to do audits of our inspection staff. So we need to meet a certain criteria to continue to be able to do those inspections for FDA. This particular program is headed by Dave Reed. We've got 30 inspectors out in the field. We will have 3 supervisors. We have 2 supervisors right now. And then we have what's known as food standards compliance officers. Those are the folks that if a particular firm, for whatever reason, is not complying with food safety laws and regulations, and despite our best efforts of education, warning letters, and encouragement, if they still won't comply, then we move it into the compliance arena, and then our compliance officers get involved. And again, our inspectors live in the area where they inspect. If there are no questions about the food program, I'll go on to our Equal to Meat program. This particular program, we're considered equal to. And what that means is that we're equal to USDA Food Inspection Service, Food Safety Inspection Service, or FSIS. So our inspectors and our inspection program is equal to that of the federal government. What that allows our small processors to do is to produce meat and be able to sell it within Minnesota's borders. Most of the meat that you get in the grocery store is likely to be inspected at a federal facility. Those plants can send that meat across state borders. Equal to facilities cannot. And then that differs a little bit from what we call custom meat slaughter facilities. And those you might have heard of as a locker plant. If you bring an animal in to be slaughtered, and then it's marked not for sale on the packages, there is no inspector on those facilities. We just inspect those for cleanliness. And we do that quarterly. So it's frequent, more frequent than a food facility, for instance. But there is nobody there to ensure that the animal is healthy. That's the owner of the animal's responsibility. And then also to ensure that of the quality of processing. And that's the reason why the meat is marked not for sale. And by not for sale, it means that it can be served, obviously, for people's families or their non-paying guests, but you can't sell it or give it away to somebody. I know sometimes churches get into trouble because they receive not-for-sale meat as a donation and then serve it for a fundraiser. What we say is that meat has lost its identity because there's not the end consumer doesn't really have control over that. And by having an inspection process, the inspector is really the proxy for the consumer. So we have 250 custom exempt facilities, and those are the locker plant facilities. Dr. Nicole Neeser does two things in our agency. She both supervises the dairy program as well as the Equal to Meat Inspection program. We have 16 field inspectors and two supervisors and then one compliance officer. It's important to note that when they do slaughter inspection, they have to be there the entire time that animal is slaughtered as well as the time that the meat is processed. So it is very time-consuming. If there are no questions about the meat inspection program, I need to discuss the funding for the Equal to Meat program. When we're considered equal to, we will get a match by the state, by the federal government of 50%. So what the state puts up, the federal government will match under some, there are some boundaries on that. And so when this program first started, and then there's been some appropriations in the past, the state meat inspection program had specific money that was dedicated, or not dedicated, but the legislature said this is for the meat inspection program. Since that time, that meat inspection program has increased, which is a good thing because that means there's more processors that are under inspection, and that part of the business in Minnesota is growing. However, the match from the state has not increased, so we've had to take that out of our food general fund dollars. And so about 11% of that is currently not covered by the original state meat inspection appropriation. So any more inspectors, it would be very difficult to add in any more inspectors without specific funding for those. So that's one of the limiting factors for any of the new facilities that want to come online. And then finally, it's our feed inspection program. That is almost, it's over 80% what we call dedicated accounts. The rest of it is federally funded. And the federal funds are for, similar to the food program, we do inspections for FDA. And those are primarily the ones that mix medicated feed, so the facilities that add antibiotics into the feed. Those are the ones that are that we get money from the federal government to do. The authority is a bit different, though, than the food program. We actually go under FDA's authority to do these feed inspections. So that really limits the amount of data or the amount of information that we can share about certain facilities. In the food inspection program, we do it under contract so that we do it under our state authority. Then we also do tissue residue inspections, and that has to do with BSC or mad cow disease. So ensuring that there's not tissue from mammalian animals going into feed where it shouldn't be going, or back to mammalian animals again. Dave Reed also manages two program areas. He's the program manager for the feed unit, and then Doug Luters is a program supervisor. Again, those folks live where they inspect, and we have it's a different series under the they're called actually agricultural specialists, agricultural advisors, and agricultural consultants. And so those we currently have 13 of those that are out in the field doing that type of work. Lastly, we do have a team called our Rapid Response Team that does our outbreak and contamination investigations. We received some funding from the federal government, which will actually it's not in the next biennium because it's set to expire in July. We were one of six states that received this funding to rapidly respond to foodborne, not only contaminations, but also foodborne illness outbreaks. Of note, and I think it's in your packet there, that the Center for Science and the Public Interest ranked Minnesota as one of the benchmark states for foodborne outbreak investigations. And they ranked all the states from A to F. And Minnesota and Oregon were considered one of the benchmark states. And this is a testament not only to our inspectors and investigators' abilities, but it's also the collaboration that we do with our Department of Health. And so teaming up with them, they're doing the epidemiology part, and our department doing the tracing, and then also our laboratory is really critical in solving these types of outbreaks. So with that, I will take any questions.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Very good. Thank you very much for your presentation. That's probably all we have time for today. So we'll start now with we'll finish up with marketing and biofuels and part animal health the next meeting.
Sounds good, Mr. Chairman.
Right.
Thank you very much.
No other questions have come up. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.